This is Wins and Losses with Clay Travis. Clay talks with the most entertaining people in sports, entertainment, and business. Now, here's Clay Travis.
Welcome in Wins and Losses podcast. I am Clay Travis, and we're about to be joined by Ovik Roy, who I think you guys are really going to enjoy. He's been doing fantastic work looking at the data surrounding the coronavirus, making recommendations on so many different levels, been writing for the Wall Street Journal, among other locations. We have never actually spoken before, but I am impressed by the work that he's done. I found him on social media over the last several months, and we bring him in now. Ovik Roy, let me go ahead and start here. How can people find you on social media? How can they read your work, Ovik? And thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Clay. Well, thanks to my eccentric parents, my name is spelled A-V-I-K, not Ovik, O-V-I-K. It's A-V-I-K, and that's my Twitter handle, A-V-I-K, just like it sounds, A-V as in Victor, I-K.
All right, so your background, as we get into so many different interesting topics that I want to discuss with you, but what is your educational background that led you into the profession that you have now, and what do you do for a living?
It's a bit of a zigzag path. My undergraduate degree was in molecular biology at MIT, and then I went to medical school at Yale, and then instead of becoming a doctor or a scientist, I went into biotechnology investing, where I invested in companies trying to develop new treatments for diseases, vaccines, all that sort of thing. And then I got really interested in healthcare reform, and that led me down the rabbit hole of healthcare policy and economic policy in general, and worked on a bunch of presidential campaigns, and now I run a think tank in Austin, Texas, called the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, where we come up with ideas to help more Americans climb up the economic ladder of success.
All right, so I'm fascinated by several different things you've already told us. So what is the reaction? You go to MIT, and then you go to Yale Medical School, and I don't know the answer to this. I went to law school, and I practiced law for a couple of years. And even not practicing law was considered to be a sort of a risky choice by many people because you have a good profession that's out there. What percentage of your classmates or people who go to a medical school as good as Yale end up not actually practicing medicine when they graduate?
Well, it's a small percentage. At most schools, it's probably close to zero. But Yale was a particular place where they actually encouraged you to pursue your interests outside of medical school. It was like a pass-fail system and things like that. And so I'd say in a typical Yale class, which is 100 people per class, about 5 to 10 end up doing something that's sort of like, you know, in law school, it's very typical, right? A lot of lawyers go into things other than law. Medicine,
especially. Yeah, especially after a few years. Most people have to go in and make money initially, but then they'll start to filter out. Everybody, I always say, who's a lawyer has got a dream of not being a lawyer. But most people who go to medicine, that's why I was interested, most people who go to medical school go on and practice. So is that something you came to a decision before you even started medical school? Or what was it about sort of the capitalistic economy, I guess, of the biotechnology universe that attracted you more than being a traditional doctor?
Well, my dad was also a scientist. He was a biochemist. And so I grew up around all these incredible people who had been like the people who had characterized DNA and RNA and were the pioneers in this modern field of genetics and biology that we're now living in. So I always had this real excitement about it. I thought I wanted to be a scientist. And then, you know, the problem is like, you know, at MIT, a quarter of the faculty has Nobel Prizes. And I'm walking around and I'm like, there is no way I'm going to win a Nobel Prize. I'm not smart enough. So how am I going to actually do something useful to the world? I don't know. So I struggled with it for a while. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I can invest in biotech companies. I can help build the latest new cure for some disease. And that would be something useful I could do with my life. And that led me down that path. And here I am doing this now. Because obviously, healthcare reform and economic policy in general affects so many people. A lot of people struggle to find affordable health insurance. And there are a lot of cures that we need to have for diseases that people have. And not just in healthcare, a lot of other areas, higher education. How do you afford college? How do you afford to keep the lights on in your house? There are lots of things where we need new ideas, and it's been fun to work on trying to develop those ideas.
Okay, so how do you decide? So I'm kind of fascinated by the concept of being an investor in biotechnology companies. Because you obviously have to be sophisticated to even understand as an investor. Like for people out there who don't really think about it very much, being a quote unquote sophisticated investor is typically requires a certain net worth, but you can invest in a variety of different companies, sometimes for better or ill. But biotechnology, I would imagine, there's a lot of, you tell me, but I would imagine there's a lot of snake oil salesmen out there who are trying to peddle things that may or may not make a lot of sense. So I would think a medical degree like yours would basically, for lack of a better way to describe it, allow you to speak the language so that you're maybe better able to understand, and maybe also your dad being involved help with that as well. But what was your process like in terms of investing and finding companies that you found to be worthy of putting money behind?
Yeah, it's great and really relevant that you're bringing this up, actually, because it has a lot to do with how I ended up being a contrarian on COVID stuff. So
yes,
I entered the workforce. I finished school in 2000, and that was right around the time that the Human Genome Project had been completed. So for those who remember those days, the Human Genome Project was at the time this gigantic scientific enterprise to sequence the entire human genome, every DNA, piece of DNA in your that comprises the human genetic code from beginning to end, because that had never been done before. And that was finally finished in 2001. And there was a big dot-com boom in the 90s when the internet as we know it first came into being. And right after that dot-com bubble burst, there was this basically this genomics bubble. All these stocks called this genomics and that genomics were getting multi-billion dollar market caps, and nobody knew what they did. And a lot of it was hype. And so an investment firm I'd never heard of called Bain Capital, I happen to know a couple people who work there, and one of them reached out to me and said, hey, can you help us figure out all this genomic stuff? Because we're just a bunch of MBAs. We don't know anything about genomics. And we figure you can teach us. You have a degree in molecular biology. You can teach us about this stuff, and we can teach you how to read a balance sheet, and then maybe you can be useful. And I'm like, wow, that sounds interesting. So not really knowing the first thing about how to do any of that when I started, I got recruited to Bain Capital, moved to Boston, and started investing in biotech companies. I basically became part of this first generation of people with scientific and medical backgrounds, MDs and PhDs mostly, who started investing in biotech companies. Because it ended up, it's not like a normal stock thing where, like, normally if you turn on CNBC or something, it's like, well, the PE ratio is this, right? Or
yeah,
if you look at those conventional things. With biotech, it's not like that at all, because the clinical trial turns out positive or negative in terms of your latest cure for breast cancer or whatever, and that stock goes to zero if it fails, or it triples if it succeeds. I mean, it's total volatility. It's crazy. A lot of losses, a lot of wins. It's kind of like baseball, where if your batting average is below 500, you're probably not going to survive. But you're going to lose. You're going to be wrong plenty, and you have to put an enormous amount of effort into statistics. Right, because at the end of the day, what my job ended up becoming, and a lot of people who were like me, is we ended up being incredibly intense statisticians. Because what you end up doing is you're looking at a breast cancer trial, new drug for breast cancer. It's being tested in 50 women who have breast cancer. Well, 50 women is not a lot. So if there's 50 women who got the drug and 50 women who didn't, and let's say that trial got really hyped. Oh, this drug really works. And the 50 women who got the drug, they really did better. They lived longer. Their breast tumors went away. But what if what happened was actually the people who were in the placebo arm of the trial were actually sicker in the beginning, and that skews the results? Or maybe they measured the tumors in the wrong way. So there's all sorts of subtleties about a way a clinical trial operates that you can then make a bet and say, okay, is this drug overhyped or underhyped? Are people overhyping this drug? As you said, like, is it snake oil, where there's this trial that's been published in the New England Journal of Medicine that says this drug really works, but then in a larger trial with thousands of patients, it's going to fail? Or is it the other way around? Maybe it's a drug that didn't do that well in early stage trials, but in bigger trials, there is a signal there and it ends up being really successful. Those are the kinds of things that people like me were making bets on, and betting tens of, in fact, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars trying to figure out which side was right.
How'd you do?
I did all right. That's what kind of gave me the freedom to start a nonprofit on a lark, because
yeah,
I had a financial cushion.
All right. So that is all interesting and fascinating background. And you said something a couple of minutes ago. You said that your work at Bain Capital and your work in going to MIT and also going to Yale Medical School and putting it to work, molecular biology, looking at the genome projects, all of these different things obviously led you to being able to look at data and figure out what I would call, for lack of a better way, what the signal is versus what the noise is. So there's so much noise on a day-to-day basis, regardless of what you do for a living. Whatever people are doing for livings where they listen to us out there, most of it is external noise that isn't really getting to the essence of what you do figuring out the signal is essentially what you had to do for these biochemistry and investigations, for lack of another way of putting it. That also then corresponds in an incredibly unique way with what's happened with the coronavirus, where every day it seems to me we are deluged with data, with news, with viral stories, meaning not necessarily virus stories, but literally stories that go viral about the virus. How do you cut through that noise and figure out what the real signal is? So let's go in. The story starts in January. When did you first become aware of the coronavirus and start to read and pay attention to it in China?
Well, I started hearing the stories right away in you know, just January, February, when the news started to break. But at that time, we didn't know that it was coming. I think it was, when was the first case in Washington State? It was, I want to say, February. Maybe it was late January. So we started to hear about this thing in Wuhan. There was a lot of suppression, and then we started to see the cases in Washington, and certainly followed that all the way through, because healthcare policy and healthcare stuff is on my radar always as part of my job.
So you said you were comfortable early on with looking into the data and maybe becoming somewhat of a contrarian in terms of what your analysis has done such a good job of, I think, is for people who don't know. And again, I would encourage them to go follow you on Twitter at AVIK, Ovik Roy, we are talking to right now. He does incredible work looking at the data and putting it in context. And I believe the first time I started to see your data percolate on my feed and start to follow it aggressively was when you were looking at risk factors for college-age kids, comparing, let's say, the seasonal flu and also with kids who were elementary school age, and saying, hey, I understand that, you know, there's a lot of attention on the coronavirus right now, but the data would reflect that most young people are under greater danger from the seasonal flu or pneumonia. That's a counterintuitive data fact. When did you start to dive into the numbers in such a way? Because this is eerily similar, I would think, and I bet you would agree, with what you were doing looking at these biotech trials, where the headline might be one thing, but when you actually go and look underneath the surface and start to examine it, some of the data is telling a different story maybe than the data that the media is sharing at the top line level of reporting.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Clay. I mean, you've hit it on the head. And I would say also, by the way, I think one of the reasons when I listen to your show and your podcast, you do an amazing job of just walking people through the real statistical situation. And I think that goes to show that there's an analogous situation in sports. Right. You think about this explosion in sports analytics today. And what is that all about? It's all about the fact that conventional ways of measuring performance in sports, starting with baseball, but it's true in every sport, don't necessarily accurately measure how a player or a team is performing. And so there's been this explosion of trying to be much more rigorous about how to measure that. And on Wall Street, that's basically what you're doing on Wall Street, too. You're trying to say, at least in biotech investing, and it's not just true in biotech investing, but it's especially true in biotech investing, what you're trying to figure out is, okay, this stock is really hyped. What are people getting wrong? This stock is down in the dumps. What are people getting wrong? You're training, if you try to be good, try to outperform, is to always try to swim against the tide and try to identify what other people aren't thinking about when they look at the data. And that habit of mind, or cast of mind, if you want to call it, that's what's driven all my policy work too. When I write about public policy, when I write about healthcare, when I write about COVID, it's all about, okay, what are people missing? And the obvious thing right away was this real skew in the age distribution of who was getting really sick and who was dying from COVID. There was a huge skew towards the elderly. And I started writing about this pretty early on, that the early data out of China, the early data out of Italy, the places that really got hit a little bit before the U.S. got hit, they all were showing the same skew, where in the case of the U.S., literally 80% of the people who've died of COVID are over the age of 65. And I would start writing about this and tweeting about it and putting it in our work at freeop.org, which is our think tank. And some people would ask me, like, well, okay, that's interesting. 80% of the people are the ones over 65. Isn't that true of most things? Don't most things end up, you know, basically killing the elderly more than they kill young people? So I was actually curious to say, okay, let's actually try to dig into that and figure out, okay, how does the skew work for a more conventional infectious disease like influenza, compared to COVID, because if you look at the history of influenza pandemics, they actually do hurt and kill children. They do kill young people. The famous influenza pandemic of 1918 killed a lot of soldiers. More soldiers died because of influenza than died, at least American soldiers, than died actually fighting in the trenches in World War One. So a lot of young people died then. That's why we closed the schools if there's like a crazy influenza pandemic. So I was interested in this. And what I found, if you actually look at CDC data, official government data, over a 10-year period from 2007 to 2017, which is their most recent cut of the data, and you compare the number of people who died from influenza by age bracket to those who've died from COVID, you see a much worse skew for COVID. In other words, COVID is much more skewed in terms of serious illness or death towards the elderly than your typical infectious disease or any other kind of disease.
So this is interesting to me, too, because one of the aphorisms, I would say, about war, and you know, people who listen to this know also that I'm a history buff and I love, you know, studying American and other history a lot. You typically end up fighting the most recent war with the technology from the previous war, right? Because everybody who has studied all the things that have happened in warfare is going to apply the lessons that have applied from prior war. But you're then, you know, let's use the Civil War for an example, which is a particular interest of mine. You're using the Napoleonic tactics, but now the technology, the ability of rifles, cannons, all of the rapid fire weapons have changed. So the mortality rate skyrockets, right? Because you're fighting and gradually you adjust and people learn, hey, maybe we should be fighting in a different way. The reason why I use that as an example is so many people, and this frustrated me, and I bet it frustrated you when you actually looked at the data. So many people used data from the flu to justify shutting down schools based on the coronavirus. But this particular COVID infection was not like the flu in that the age range of the impacted were different. So the decision to shut down schools might well have made sense in the pandemic 100 years ago. And you study it and you say, oh, that's the lesson we should take away. But it's not the same virus. So you're fighting a new virus, which has never existed before, with the tactics that would have worked against a virus 100 years ago, that's a misfit, right? But most people aren't sophisticated enough to think about that. You were, but that has to be frustrating to you from a public policy perspective to see it and not be able to cut through the noise and make people realize the data and what you've seen.
Well, first of all, let me just say, you're absolutely right, 1,000%. This issue of fighting the last war is exactly what's going on here. And there's so many different dimensions of how that's true, Clay. I'll give you one. So you heard people say, well, there were these plans in place from the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration. Why didn't Trump use those plans to fight the coronavirus? Well, those plans were not designed for coronavirus. They were designed for influenza. In fact, if you actually look at the cover page of the reports, they say things like, our plan for dealing with a novel influenza pandemic. Now, influenza is a different virus from coronaviruses like the SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. And again, this is part of having that molecular biology background from MIT. I understand the difference between different types of viruses and how they actually infect you and how they actually work in the body. They're very different. And so it's very important to understand that not all viruses are the same. The way they behave in your body, their lethality, their virulence can be very different. And so to your point, yes, closing schools in a severe influenza pandemic makes sense because young children and young adults do get killed from really bad influenza pandemics in the case of 1918 especially. But this is not an influenza pandemic. And it's also true of all these sort of public health epidemiologist types. So one of the things you'll see a lot of people say, particularly on social media, is, well, how dare you write or tweet about COVID? You don't have a right to have an opinion because you're not an epidemiologist. Now, the problem is, first of all, epidemiology is, we could get into have a long discussion about what you actually learn in epidemiology school or, you know, epidemiology grad school or public health school. But a lot of how epidemiologists or public health officials, how they cut their teeth, is studying things like influenza pandemics. So a lot of the pronouncements that they're making with this incredible certainty in the sense, well, if you don't listen to me, you're against science, are based on historical evidence of what has worked or what has happened with influenza. And this is a completely new virus that we've never seen before. And so a lot of that expertise doesn't really work because you're dealing with something completely different.
And I want to circle back right now because you just said something. Somebody says, oh, you're not an epidemiologist. You're not a virologist. I try to share intelligent people. You went to MIT. You went to Yale Medical School. I've got decent degree background as well. But ultimately, intelligent people who are contrarians or who are skeptics are very often right. And people who think that they are the quote unquote experts very often are wrong when you actually look at the data, right? And so when you say, hey, we're only going to listen to scientists or we're only going to listen to quote unquote experts, I mean, the data is telling us a story that it shouldn't matter who's telling the story, right? Like when you are coming out and sharing your data on why schools should be back open based on looking at the direct CDC data, that's more valid than somebody who studied the influenza outbreak 100 years ago and is trying to draw lessons from there. Yet it seems to me like in the public media sphere, there's more benefit given to those epidemiologists maybe than would be justified based on the data. That's a kind of a long-winded question, but you have to see that on a regular basis with what you've been writing and talking about.
Well, I would agree with you, but I would also describe it in a different way because there is not consensus in the scientific
yes.
community. And it is actually anti-scientific to demand that alternative hypotheses be thrown out for no reason. Right?
Yeah.
If there's actual evidence about what's happening and the evidence heavily weights in one direction or another, that's one thing. But in a situation where you're dealing with an unknown virus that we've never seen before and that's spreading in a way that has unique characteristics, then you as a scientist, and again, my dad was a scientist. I grew up around science my whole life. As a scientist, you're obligated not to throw out any theory, any hypothesis, until you can convincingly, with the evidence, disprove it. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that plausible scientific theories are being suppressed. I'll give you an example. There's an epidemiologist, a biomathematician who does a lot of things around population health, named Gabriela Gomez. And she tweeted a couple weeks ago that she actually has been trying to write some stuff about herd immunity, population immunity, and how that population immunity may be closer at hand than other people think. And she can't get the work published in scientific journals because some people have shared with her, the editors of these journals say, well, if we publish your work and people become less scared of COVID, then maybe that will lead people to not wear masks and stuff. And we don't want that. Therefore, we've got to keep this kind of optimistic take off the table. Now, that's not science, right? It's not science when you artificially suppress, for subjective or political reasons, alternative hypotheses of what's going on. And that's the lesson I really want to drive home here, is a lot of the people who are screaming the loudest about trusting the science are not actually acting scientifically. Because if you're acting scientifically, you're looking very hard at the data, you're not ruling out any theory until you've got convincing evidence that it's wrong.
That's really well said and much better than my sort of haphazard question that I asked there. Why do you think that is? So why do you think it is? And that's hugely important, I think. The scientific method is a rigorous adversarial system, right? There are a lot of people out there who believe science only has one answer, right? Because we've proven, say, what the boiling point of water is or what the freezing point is. But that had to be tested over time, right? And when you have these rigorous battles over what might or might not be the truth, that's how science advances. But when you don't allow that battle, to me, it kind of ties in with the marketplace of ideas and why I'm such a huge First Amendment absolutist. When you constrict sort of the available universe of argument or discussion, you are actually penalizing our ability to arrive at a truth or a universally ultimately recognized truth, right? I mean, the entire purpose of science is I've got this hypothesis, let me test it. When you start saying to people, oh, that hypothesis makes people uncomfortable, we can't discuss it, you're actually combating science.
That's exactly right. And one important element of this that's essential to really think about and where you can really get your spidey sense up in a sense is when people conflate predictions with facts. A prediction is about something that may happen in the future. And look, it may be more probable that Alabama wins the national championship than Michigan State. But it isn't guaranteed that Alabama is going to win the national championship, right? And so similarly, in science, you hear a lot of people say, well, it's a fact that X will happen in the future. But we don't know, because the world is a very complex place and there are a lot of variables that go into whether something happens or not, especially when you're talking about a novel virus that no one has ever seen before. And so that's where there's particularly been a poisonous climate, where if you have a different view as to what may happen in the future in a situation where there's a lot of uncertainty, there's been a lot of suppression and debate of that, because we can't give anybody reason to be optimistic, because if you're optimistic, then maybe, you know, you'll hang out at a bar with your friends and communicate the disease to other people, and we can't have that. And the problem is, if you engage in that kind of, let's call it, dishonest suppression, then people don't listen to you because they don't trust you. Right? If they don't trust you, they're going to say, you know what, I don't trust that guy who's telling me not to do all this stuff, because he's been wrong half the time anyway, and he's demanding that I listen to him because he's a scientist. Well, then I'm not going to believe in science. And that's actually more dangerous for science and the scientific enterprise, that people cloak themselves in the word science, but they're not actually being scientific, because then people out there say, well, if that's what science is, then I'm not for it.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
We're talking to Ovick Roy. I'm Clay Travis. This is Wins and Losses. I mean, this subject has utterly fascinated me on several different levels, and you know that I've spent a lot of time talking about this from the sports perspective, and we're going to circle around to it on a sports perspective. But it seems to me, you've talked about the analytics revolution that we've seen in sports. It seems to me that the essence of why our national conversation about the coronavirus has been so bad ultimately boils down to something you were just talking about, which is there's a very poor understanding of statistics and probability in this country. And I'm going to give people out there, and I want to give you a chance to tee off on this too. But and really, it kind of goes to why you've been able to be successful looking at biotech companies. I think it goes to why I've been successful in my chosen field of life. It's because I tend to be skeptical of consensus opinion and actually look at the data myself. But you talked about, you know, Alabama playing Michigan State. Sports fans are universally bad about this, in college football in particular. There's an idea that if a team plays and one team beats the other one, that means that team was quote unquote better. But the reality is, and this has been something I love thinking about, you know, if you played a million minute game instead of a 60 minute game, the team that played for a million minutes, you know, is probably going to be the better team if it wins, because your data sample size is a million games. But when you play 60 minutes of a football game, any one of those 60 minutes that you pull out of the million minutes could go so many different directions. And sports fans, it seems to me, kind of understand this in the context of, oh, well, that's why we play a seven-game series, because over the course of a seven-game series, the inferior team might win by 31 game, but they might lose the other four, right? And we don't look at the sum total of the games. The coronavirus, it seems to me, and the way that the media has covered it, so many people in my industry are bad at math, right? One of the reasons why I think people become journalists is they're good at reading and writing, they're bad at math, and they're running from math and science. And I'm not great at math and science. I'm not pretending to be incredible at it, but I'm better than most people in my industry. And so the failure of understanding probability and statistics, particularly in a social media age where you say, oh, this 34-year-old woman was completely healthy and then she died, that story goes viral all over social media. Even though it's an outlier, it's in no way representative of what happens when the average 34-year-old or 24-year-old or 16-year-old gets sick with the coronavirus, yet people believe it because it's a story that they want to believe. So I've talked a lot there, kind of setting the table, but I want to circle back around to the original premise. How much of our national failure with the coronavirus has to do with a national failure to understand probability and statistics?
Well, I would say there's no doubt that our response to the coronavirus has been utterly and badly damaged by a failure to understand statistics. By the way, you're selling yourself short, Clay. I mean, I've listened to your show. You do an amazing job of communicating what's really going on from a quantitative standpoint to your audience. And you're doing an incredible public service because you have such a big audience and you're sharing this data with a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't get it from anywhere else. So I want to thank you for that.
I'm trying, but by the way, I get crushed for it, right? Like I get crushed because people are like, oh my God, you're a sports guy who went to law school. Why in the world? And the reality is because I want sports to come back. But when I see something that I believe is factually inaccurate and being discussed poorly by media, it just draws me and I want to try to get real facts out there in a way that they're not being. So I appreciate you saying that, but I'm sure you get this all the time, and I get it certainly. Like, you don't care about people dying. No, I wish nobody ever died, right? I wish we were all immortal. I wish your grandma, my grandma, everybody's kids, everybody was safe forever. That's not the reality of the world in which we live, and I am troubled by what I would say is this very poor ability to discuss complex issues where it's like, people either are like, hey, we've got to completely shut down, nobody can leave their homes, or we got to be completely wide open. And it's like the nuance is we need to be somewhere in the middle. We need to be living our lives, but not allowing the coronavirus to destroy our world, if that makes sense.
Well, totally. And I can give you some concrete examples of how this has played out in real time. So one example is school closures, right?
Yes.
We're seeing all these, and let's leave colleges aside for the moment, but I'm talking about pre-K, kindergarten, primary school, elementary school, that the overwhelming scientific evidence at this point, I mean, basically it's anti-scientific to argue that kids are at risk, in a meaningful way. Obviously, there's a handful, there's literally like 39 kids aged 1 to 15 who've died of COVID in the United States out of 50 million.
Repeat that again, because I think it's a big deal. According to the most recent CDC data, kids 15 and under, 39 have died of the coronavirus?
Between the ages of 1 and 15. 39.
And by the way, that's with the coronavirus, because I bet if you went into those 39, what you would find is they have significant health issues on top of whatever they got from the COVID impact, right?
That's right. It's people who have died who've tested positive for COVID. Whether the actual cause of death was COVID or not, we don't know. But 39 kids, and guess how many kids live in the United States who are aged 1 to 14 or 1 to 15?
I mean, there's, 330-ish million people in the United States. I would guess that there's got to be, 50 or 60 million kids at that age?
57 million. 57 million. So we're saying 39 deaths from COVID out of 57 million kids. And we're shutting down schools. And by the way, you know what that means? Shutting down schools is not exactly good for children, particularly low-income kids who have no other alternative. If you're a single mom and you have to work, let's say you work at a pharmacy or a grocery store, what are you going to do? Are you going to go to work and leave your three-year-old at home? You can't. There's 40,000, estimated there are about 40,000 cases of child abuse that are going unreported in the United States because schools are closed right now. 40,000, let alone the mental health, the educational deficits, the emotional development. It's just the incredible cost. So, like, we often talk about this purely in terms of what's your risk of getting COVID, what's your risk of not getting COVID. And we don't talk about the costs on the other side of the equation, the cost to a kid who doesn't get to go to school. The cost to a business that shuts down permanently. It's estimated that over 100,000 businesses, maybe even more, have shut down permanently because they didn't have the cash cushion. Once you start losing your revenue, but you can't keep your payroll going, you can't pay the rent for your building, and you're done, and you quit. That's not good for a lot of people. And people say, well, it's just about dollars. No, it's not just about dollars. There's actually a lot of evidence that shows that when you have a massive economic dislocation or a massive recession or a massive disruption, that leads to shortened life expectancy as well for a lot of different reasons. Think about the opioid crisis. Where is that happening? Economically depressed parts of the country to a significant degree.
Why do you think that all of those facts, which are so incredibly important, are not able to cut through the noise? That's a big question that I have because it's frustrating to me. I understand the audience, and I'm fortunate to have a substantial audience that we have built up. But I'm still a pinprick of the overall media audience, right? Why do you think that data that you just shared, and by the way, credit to the Wall Street Journal for carrying your story, was on the front page. I mean, your work is getting out there, and I think you're doing an incredible job of it. But why do you think those stories, those facts, are having such difficulty cutting through the noise? And there are so many people out there with kids that are terrified that their kids are going to die of COVID that would not think twice about ever pulling their kid out of school from the seasonal flu, even though the seasonal flu is far more dangerous. And by the way, don't even think twice about sending their kid out to a swimming pool without parental supervision when their kid is far more likely to drown there than they ever are to get COVID.
That's totally right. And, you know, just like you were saying, like, I'm lucky I have a platform. I'm the policy editor at Forbes. I can put my stuff there. I can put my stuff on Twitter. I can put my stuff at the Wall Street Journal when they ask me to. And so I've been lucky in that I've had those opportunities to get the word out there. But you're right. It's overwhelmed by the nonstop wall-to-wall alarmism coming from the people who think everything should be shut down all the time. And there's a couple of different, you know, I have a couple of different hypotheses that I think are pretty plausible as to why this is happening. The first is, the media has always been about alarmism. I mean, the thing we used to talk about, if you ever took a statistics class, the thing that people used to always talk about in statistics class was, well, people are often more afraid of flying than they are of driving their car, because every plane crash ever gets plastered all over the newspaper and plastered all over TV, right? So a lot of people have this impression that it's not safe to fly, when in fact, your chances of dying in a plane crash are orders of magnitude lower than your chances of dying in a car accident or even crossing the street in a busy intersection. So that's an example of where the media, because the disaster of the plane crash, you know, remember that the Malaysia, when that Malaysia plane went, Malaysian airline plane went
disappeared.
Down, like, CNN did nothing else for like 4 days, right?
For like so 4 months, honestly, that, Malaysian flight three. And I was fascinated by that too, because it felt like when that thing disappeared, you know, maybe there was something other, you know, we still don't know 100%. It seems like the pilot was involved. But that story was such a mystery. It was not only a plane disappearing, it was not knowing why the plane disappeared, which is probably the greatest thing ever. Another example would be shark attacks, right? Every time somebody gets attacked by a shark, you hear about it. And so everybody who goes into the ocean, summer vacation time right now, everybody is thinking, oh my God, I'm going to get eaten by a shark.
Yeah, the old school adage among, you know, the newspaper hands is, if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
Anything that's sort of catastrophic or disastrous gets that headline. And we all know that. We all consume the news. We understand that that's part of it. So that's definitely, it's like, this is catnip to that kind of journalism, right? So that's number one, I think. Number two is, for certain people who are more politically oriented, it's clearly a situation where, you know, if you're a journalist who hates Trump,
yes,
and you didn't, you know, you were frustrated by the fact that the economy was roaring along, record low unemployment in the last winter, for all races, not just whites, but also blacks and Hispanics and Asians, record low unemployment for everybody, record low disparities in the difference between unemployment of blacks and whites, for example. So the economy was doing incredibly well. So people were like, well, you know, boy, that's annoying because we hate Trump and we want him to lose. And now you have a story that you can say, ah, this is all Trump's fault. Trump is the reason why 170,000 people have died in America. And so there's an enthusiasm, in a sense, for a negative take on the government response. And I'm not trying to say the government response doesn't have things to criticize about it, whether federal, state, or local. But it is to say that has been a huge part of the story. And I'll give you some examples of why that is, or examples of how why I think that is. There, if you ask the average person on the street, you know, who watches CNN or reads the New York Times, they'll say, you know what? Why can't every governor handle COVID like Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, handled it? He's done such a great job. Why can't everyone be like him? In fact, Andrew Cuomo just published a book about his triumph in conquering COVID and wrestling it to the ground. Now, this makes absolutely no sense according to the data, because New York has been by far the worst performing state by a country mile. Like, California, Texas, and Florida combined have had far fewer deaths from COVID-19 than New York has, whether per capita or not. And yet somehow New York is portrayed as this success story. It's not a success story at all. It's been a complete catastrophic failure. Arguably, of any states that have done pretty well, it's been the Texas and the Floridas that never completely locked down their economy And while they have had deaths from COVID, it's been at a far lower scale than New York. But you wouldn't know that from the coverage. And that goes to this point about the politics. Like, if we were just looking at the data, and we would have a lot more questions we'd be asking about Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, and of Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, and a bunch of his neighbors, by the way, like Murphy in New Jersey.
It's so true. And I look at the data, and do you think that the media that is praising Andrew Cuomo and Murphy, who is next to him, and by the way, to kind of put into context the data, New York and New Jersey's death rate is twice the worst country in the world from COVID so far. The most recent numbers that I looked at, Belgium was the worst, and New York and New Jersey were twice what Belgium was, okay? Do you, and this gets into a hypothesis situation again, because we really don't know, but this is something that I just think about a great deal. I can forgive people who are ignorant because they are listening to media that is telling them things that are not true, right? Like, so if you read the New York Times and you have convinced yourself that Andrew Cuomo and Governor Murphy did an incredible job, that's because those journalists are telling you that, right? You are being told that is not a truth, but you trust the New York Times or you trust CNN to get that right. And so you are misapprehending what the data is actually saying. I'm not as bothered by people who believe things that are untrue because they're listening to people in positions of authority. I am desperately bothered by people in positions of authority in my industry, in the media, who are sharing untruths about New York and New Jersey such that people are willing to buy a book that suggests, it's supposed to come out in October, that Andrew Cuomo triumphed over the coronavirus when he literally did the worst job of any politician, arguably, in the world. I mean, it's just such an upside-down story. So do you think the journalists are not sophisticated enough to actually look at the data? Do you think they're intentionally misleading their audiences? How is it possible for something that is so untrue to become so widely believed, such that I believe right now Andrew Cuomo has the highest popularity rating of almost any governor in the country, despite clear evidence that he probably did a worse job than any politician in the entire world with the coronavirus?
Well, you know, this whole Andrew Cuomo thing is like one of the craziest aspects of this whole 6 months. It's just been, what is going on? There's such a disconnect between what his actual performance has been, and not just in terms of the numbers, in terms of COVID, in terms of his actual decisions, because a lot of his actual decisions
are
made
disastrous.
It worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which,
like,
you know about.
That
I'm going to ask you about that directly, which is because this is the other place where I really started seeing your work. We knew early on when the infection first was recognized in a Washington nursing home that the elderly people, when you looked at the data from Italy, that elderly people were particularly susceptible to this virus, and that therefore the most susceptible people in the entire country were people in nursing homes. And so what happened in New York, although they're not sharing their honest data, and I think you've been looking at this too, but you went out and looked and said, okay, where are people actually dying? And you found out that the death rate inside of nursing homes was just, I mean, like, I think in Canada, for instance, not just the United States, the data that I saw, 82% of all deaths in Canada have been inside nursing homes. And so New York believed these forecasts that they were going to need 140,000 hospital beds. They ended up peaking, and you can correct me on some of this data if I'm wrong, because I'm doing it off the top of my head. They ended up right around 19,000 actually hospital beds. So the order of the forecast was way off. But as a result, Cuomo sent all of these infected patients back into nursing homes, which was like putting kindling, you know, right beside a forest fire, and it exploded. And the same thing happened in New Jersey and in Michigan and in all these other states that had early outbreaks and followed his lead. It wasn't just that he made a poor decision. It was that all these lemming governors followed his lead and end up making disastrous decisions. So how is that still not a primary point of story? Because to me, it's the biggest story of the coronavirus outbreak from a death perspective.
Yeah, I mean, what's really important to understand about what you just described, Clay, is that Andrew Cuomo forced these nursing homes. His health department issued an order forcing the nursing homes to accept COVID-infected patients. And the nursing home operators screamed bloody murder. There's a great article from like March 27th of the Wall Street Journal that you can find. If you just Google nursing home Andrew Cuomo March, you might be able to find the article. The nursing homes knew that this was a potentially fatal decision, a literally fatal decision. If people were screaming bloody murder about it at the time, and he did it anyway, because the experts that he was talking to, quote unquote experts, told him, well, gosh, what we know from influenza, you've got to keep those hospital beds clear. We don't have to worry about the nursing homes. What we really have to worry about is the hospitals, which is totally backwards, because if you actually infect everyone in the nursing home, where do you think they're going to end up? In the hospital, deathly sick of COVID. So that was an incredibly bad decision. That was in part Andrew Cuomo's decision, but it was also a failure of experts who advised him to make that decision. And that's part of the reason why you're not seeing the accountability, because those experts don't want to, you know, take credit for that advice.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick, the coverage with Clay Travis, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We're talking to Ovik Roy. I'm Clay Travis. This is Wins and Losses. Sorry to cut you off. Continue.
Oh, please do. You know, I was going to bring up another element of this phenomenon we were talking before about just the news coverage and how distorted it is. Let me give you an example that's, in a sense, not related to what's been happening in the U.S. with COVID, but is related to the U.S. media coverage of the whole thing. There was a story published on July 18th in the New York Times by Apoorva Mondavilli, I think if I'm pronouncing that correctly. The headline of the article was, "Older Children Spread the Coronavirus Just as Much as Adults. Large study finds." The study of nearly 65,000 people in South Korea suggests that school reopenings will trigger more outbreaks. And the whole article is about the study by the South Korean CDC that actually didn't look at 65,000 kids. It looked at a couple of hundred kids and found that there were some adults in those households who also had COVID. So she published this very long article. It was probably on the front page of the New York Times, certainly very prominent placement. I read it online, so I don't know what page in the newspaper it actually appeared on. And, well, what's interesting about it is that, so that was a story that was being cited by everyone. Oh, you can't open schools because there's a South Korea study that shows that even young kids can infect everybody, even though nobody in Europe has seen this effect, nobody in the rest of the world where they've opened schools has seen this effect. In South Korea, there's a study that shows that kids will infect adults, and so we got to keep the schools closed. That was the takeaway. And you saw all this chatter in other newspapers, other media, on social media about this article in the New York Times saying this. Well, fast forward a couple weeks later, and what do we find? When the full data set is actually released by the Korean CDC, it turns out 40 of the 41 cases of kids and adults having COVID in the same household, they were infected simultaneously. It wasn't the kids infecting the adults. The kids and the adults in that household were simultaneously infected by somebody else. So 40 of 41 cases were not actually of kids infecting adults. They're of kids just getting infected by other people. The one case of COVID, somebody who was a child infecting someone else, a teenage girl infected her younger sister. And that's it. One case in the entire country of South Korea. But you're not going to see a front page story in the New York Times saying, hey, guess what, everybody? That South Korea study that we touted a couple weeks ago, totally misconceived, totally misinterpreted. It turns out it's no big deal. You're not going to see that story. And that's an example of where a factual situation, just by the way it's being covered, completely distorts a very, very important policy question, which is, do we bring 60 million kids and young adults back to school this fall?
What would the data tell us we should have done? All right, so let's pretend that that we had all this data that we have now. And for people out there who are listening to us, I'm talking to Ovik Roy, Clay Travis here, Wins and Losses, and we're talking in, I think it's August 25, days all run together. I think it's August 20th, August 21st, whatever it is. Now with the benefit of hindsight, right? Everybody always likes to say hindsight's 20/20. With all of the data that you have out there right now, what would have been the appropriate and smartest decision in March and April and May? Because it's one thing to say, and I think you would probably agree, maybe there's the fog of war in March when we shut down. A lot of people don't know what's going on. I would argue there was enough data out there to suggest that shutting completely down wasn't the smart move. But let's pretend that you have all the data, all the time that you've spent looking at everything. What is the right thing to do right now? and what would have been, let's pretend that we could have been flawless and we could have executed perfectly the appropriate response to coronavirus based on what we know now is what?
I'll give you three core ideas or core concepts or core frameworks. Number one, we should have reopened schools, particularly for kids under the age of 12, in the spring, like Europe did. And we definitely should be opening schools for younger kids starting now. That's something that Europe did. They had enormous success with it. They had no problems of kids infecting adults. And in fact, part of why Europe may be having so much more success in the U.S. in terms of the course of the pandemic is because kids went back to school, because the kids all probably got some low-level exposure to the virus, developed immunity, and also transmitted immunity to others. In fact, in Germany, that's what they think. They think that reopening schools acted as a break on the transmission of COVID-19.
So that's a counterintuitive. Yeah, that's a counterintuitive thought. Sorry to cut you off, but there's a strong argument to be made that reopening schools, rather than leading to mass outbreaks, actually makes them less likely. So in addition to the fact that kids obviously benefit from being in school, there's an argument that being in school actually makes us safer as opposed to more dangerous. I just wanted to cut you off because that's a counterintuitive take that you would hear almost nowhere else in the media. Sorry. Okay, so that's point one.
Yeah, no, if you dig into my Twitter feed and if you read the Wall Street Journal article, you'll see the links to the German scientists in particular who've been making this argument. So that's point one. Point two. We should have done a lot more, and we should still do a lot more to protect people who live in nursing homes. 45% of all the deaths in the United States from COVID-19 or with no COVID-19 have taken place among residents in nursing homes and other assisted living facilities that house 0.6% of the U.S. population. Now, in any normal crisis, the fact that 45% of the deaths were occurring in 0.6% of the population, that would be the headline every day. Every day, we'd be seeing on CNN some anchors asking a politician, what are you doing to protect people in nursing homes today? That's what we'd be talking about every hour of every day. But we're not. Why is that? That's one of the craziest things about this whole situation. So we should have done all along a lot more to protect people in nursing homes, and we still have a ways to go to do that, to get to a point where we can really say that people in nursing homes are protected. We've made a lot of progress in a sense of like a little bit too late. We should have gotten there much earlier, particularly at the state level, as we've talked about with Andrew Cuomo. But that's an area where we still need to do more. So that would be like fucking.
And by the way, that 45% figure is probably low because the data that you have on New York, the way they classify nursing home deaths, likely drastically undercuts the number of people who actually died who were in nursing homes in New York, right? It's probably the case, like I mentioned earlier, Canada, it's 82%. It's probably over half in the United States, right? If you had the best possible statistical data of all to be able to put together. That's not a crazy hypothesis, right?
No, and in fact, if you want to dig into the data, or if any of your listeners want to dig into the data, they can go to our website, FREOPP, freeop.org, and there's an article there titled Nursing Homes and Assisted Living Facilities Account for 45% of COVID-19 Deaths. And we put all the data in there. I also have a Forbes article about it, but the freeop.org article is the one that has the most updated information. You can dig through at the state level how your state's been doing. And by the way, when we first started reporting on this, we basically compiled all the data from the state health departments. And 13 states weren't even reporting the data.
Yeah.
This is in like June. 13 states weren't even reporting the data. It wasn't until I basically humiliated them by writing this article in Forbes that got like 1.2 million page views that all of a sudden the State Department started to say, oh, yeah, actually, here's our nursing home deaths. So, it was just this crazy thing where, again, 45 or half the deaths, maybe more, are coming in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. And yet some states weren't even reporting the data. They didn't even know what percentage of the people in their state that were dying were in nursing homes. In some parts of the country, it's even higher than 50%. In Minnesota, it's like Canada. It's like 80%. And so that was one of the things that's like absolutely a thing that we could have done better then. We certainly could be doing better now. And then the third bucket is the economic lockdowns. So you'll remember when Texas and Florida, Florida didn't ever really completely lock down, but Texas did lock down in May. And then they reopened in June, and there were all these predictions in national newspapers and other media organizations about how Texas, hundreds of thousands of people were going to die. It was going to be terrible. It was going to be apocalyptic. These rednecks from Texas didn't know what they were doing. And if you go by those predictions of tens or hundreds of thousands of people dying compared to what actually happened, yes, there have been people who died of COVID in Texas. There was a rise in cases and hospitalizations and deaths in the late summer, but much, much less so than was predicted, far less so. We were never in Texas. It never turned into a New York, and Florida never turned into a New York. These places that reopened in the Sun Belt, they never turned into New York. And yet there was this kind of almost rooting for that failure to happen. And that's, I think what that shows is that there is a balance to be struck. And there's a lot of actually academic research on this that never really gets talked about, that there's diminishing returns to a total lockdown. Yes, it may or may not make sense to close bars. It certainly probably makes sense to not have large gatherings of like sporting events or conventions or things like that where you have 100,000 people packed into a stadium. That's probably a thing you want to avoid. But things like allowing restaurants to open at half capacity, allowing people to go into a shop with a mask on, that's not a big deal, right? Let the car washes open up. Just because a car wash is not a quote-unquote essential business doesn't mean that a car wash has to be shut down. You can drive your car through the car wash and it's basically fine. So there is a balance to be struck, and Texas and Florida clearly struck that balance in a way that the total lockdown states did not. And exhibit A, by the way, on that, Clay, is California. Look at California. California's had the same spike in cases and hospitalizations and deaths that Texas and Florida did. But California locked down. California did all the things that all the people in the sort of the quote-unquote, the pro-quote-unquote, pro-quote science-unquote class says we should do, and yet California still had an outbreak. Why is that, right? So why is it that California right now, the situation is arguably worse? California had a complete breakdown of their data system. They don't even know how many people have COVID or have tested positive because their testing data center broke down. So all that to say that the third bucket, I'd say, in terms of what we need to do better is we need to identify, we need to be very objective about what measures have worked and what measures have not worked in terms of limiting the spread, flattening the curve, et cetera. It's pretty clear at this point that the Texas-Florida model strikes the right balance. And by the way, as you know, Clay, I don't have to remind you, I probably don't have to remind your listeners, when we originally locked down in May, the argument was not that we were going to obliterate COVID-19. It was that we were going to flatten the curve so that the hospitals weren't overwhelmed. Well, no hospitals are getting overwhelmed anywhere today.
We're talking to Ovik Roy. You can follow him on Twitter at AVIK. I encourage you to go read all of his work. He went to MIT, Yale Medical School, and this is Wins and Losses. I'm Clay Travis. All right, so this there's a lot I could still unpack about what you just said for your ideas about how we should be responding today. I love that you got the three prong there. How much of what we're doing is cosmetic theater? And what I mean by that is, in New York, if you look at the rates of infection, it seems like based on the recent data that the governor of Florida has shared, there are many parts of Florida with similar rates of infection to New York. It seems like there is a curve, a steep curve, and then it starts back down. In fact, the rates of infection in the Northeast, if you look at the rates per million or whatever the heck it is, it's almost identical to what we've eventually seen in the South. And while everybody was panicking, on some level, isn't a virus going to be a virus no matter what we do? And that even if you shut down for a long time, eventually people are going to go back outside and the virus is going to spread again. Is it that, like, to me, there's early on, I think, and look, I'm far from an expert, but there's only two ways to end a virus. One is by vaccine, and I'll ask you about a vaccine in a little bit. The other is about herd immunity. And it seems to me like there is a lot of data out there now which would suggest that the herd immunity requirement is way lower than we were initially told. Initially, and you'll know better than me, but it's like, hey, you need 70 or 80% of the population to be exposed to it. There's no way we can actually do that. And the reality is maybe it's only 10 to 20%, but if you even are willing to discuss that, it's like, oh, you don't care about somebody's grandma dying. How dare you? Which seems to circle back again around to your initial point, which is science is not science. It's like it's got to have a certain negative bent to it, or else you're not allowed to share it. So what data are you seeing about herd immunity And what would you surmise based on that data as we speak in mid to late August?
Well, before I get to that, let me talk about the other piece of your question, which was, well, how can we get through this crisis? What are the ways? You mentioned two of them. You mentioned herd immunity. You mentioned the vaccine. There's actually a third, which is you could have a drug that treats the disease caused by the virus in a way that it doesn't require a vaccine. For example, hepatitis C, there's no vaccine for hepatitis C, but in recent years there have emerged treatments that are effectively cures for hepatitis C that still, the virus still bounces around the country, but your liver will not fail. You will not need a liver transplant if you take the drug.
And the same thing would be for HIV, right? Where we have treatments, but there's no vaccine.
Yeah, the smartest people in the world have been working on an HIV vaccine for 40 years. We still don't have an HIV vaccine, but we do have effective treatments that mean that it used to be, you and I know because we're of that age, in the 80s, if you had HIV, it was a death sentence. It's not a death sentence today. People are living a pretty a long lives, even if they have HIV well controlled by these drugs that are not vaccines. So you'll remember, Clay, that when we first locked down in the spring, that was the argument, actually. It was, well, we're only going to have to lock down for a couple weeks because there are a bunch of biotech companies that are developing these drugs that are going to end up curing the disease, and we're not going to have to worry about it. It's only going to be a couple weeks. 15 days to slow the spread was one of the catchphrases that was out there. And I was writing at the time, my original cover story in the Wall Street Journal on COVID from April was about this fact that actually, as somebody who's invested in a lot of biotech companies, people are totally overestimating the probability of success here. Most drugs that enter clinical trials fail. By far, like 90%. So the idea that we're just going to, flip a switch or snap our fingers and we're going to have a cure for COVID, it's not going to necessarily work that way. It may be months or even years before we have a drug like we do now for hepatitis C or HIV. Those drugs took years and decades to develop. So this idea that we're going to wait for a cure in terms of a drug to be on the market before we reopen the economy, we could be waiting years. We could basically destroy the economy permanently if we do that. So that was one of my arguments early on, and not just mine, with my co-authors too, which included some people who are on both sides of the political aisle, so to speak. We were saying, look, you can't destroy the economy for that long because businesses will permanently close and there's no assurance that effective treatments will come along. So that was back in the spring. That theory has been proven right? There is still not any drug on the market that cures COVID. Obviously, there are treatments that people are more hopeful about than others, but nothing is incontrovertibly a cure. So then let's talk about the vaccine. So you hear a lot of hype about vaccines. Well, we're going to have a vaccine by the end of the year, some people say. Now, look, we all hope that's true, but it's very important to understand that the world record for the fastest vaccine ever developed for a novel virus is 5 years. It took 5 years to develop a vaccine for the Ebola virus. That was the record up to now. So we're talking about having a vaccine in less than a year, which would be 5x the world record for speed of vaccine development. Now, there's a lot of advances in technology. There are a lot of people working on this. There's been a lot of money put to work. So it's possible that all that ends up working. But we can't be assured of that. And if the idea is that we're going to keep schools closed and businesses closed and the economy shut down until we have a vaccine, what if we are waiting 2, 3, 4, 5 years for a vaccine? We just can't. So we have to have a plan B in case a vaccine fails. And now that gets to the third thing that you mentioned, which is the herd immunity or population immunity. Is it possible that, like a forest fire, which eventually rages for a while, but then eventually runs out of dry wood to burn, could we end up in a situation where COVID eventually flames out? And it is possible. I mean, that is, I think, my personal view is that's what we're seeing in New York City. That's what we're seeing in Sweden, that you had high death tolls early on, but over time, the people who are susceptible succumbed, tragically, unfortunately, to the virus, and the people who are left standing are not that susceptible. And that's why, that's not Andrew Cuomo flexing his biceps, but actually the fact that the susceptible people in New York are already dead.
And do you buy into this idea that, based on the data you're seeing, that the herd immunity threshold by which you start to see substantial protections is maybe a lot lower than what was initially told by the quote-unquote experts?
There's good evidence of that. We were talking earlier in the show, Clay, about Gabriela Gomez, a scientist who has modeled this out and can't get her research published by scientific journals because it's not alarmist enough. And there's been some publications in other medical and scientific journals that suggest this, that people don't know, right? That there's the sort of more negative view is that you need 80% of a population to be infected in order for herd immunity to take place. Now, for those who don't know what herd immunity is, let me just maybe pause and explain that. So what herd immunity is the idea that so many people have been exposed to the virus that the virus itself can't explode. Like, for the virus to really explode and infect other people, you know, you as the infected person have to wander around, encounter a bunch of other people who are not yet infected, and spread the virus to those other people. Now, if two out of three of those people are already immune because they've been infected in the past, then maybe there's a chance that that third person gets infected, but the probabilities are lower. The analogy might be trying to throw a golf ball through a chain link fence. Yeah, the hole in the chain link fence is big enough for you to throw the golf ball through it. But if you've ever tried to throw a golf ball through a chain link fence, there's at least a 50% chance or more that you hit one of the links in the fence and the ball falls to the ground, right? So similarly here, if a bunch of people are already immune, the probability or the ability of the virus to really spread cuts down dramatically. So that's what herd immunity is. It's basically a virus basically failing to spread because enough people have already been immune. And what's very, very interesting, and this is something that you see a lot in the background of the scientific literature, but it doesn't get the hype, is that there may be more herd immunity, or the threshold you need to get to herd immunity for COVID is a lot lower than maybe the more negative side thinks. And the reason for that is that the common cold is also a coronavirus. And so it may be that there are a bunch of other very mild coronaviruses that are out there that people have gotten over the last winter or longer that have given them enough immunity to SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, that herd immunity from COVID, from actually being infected with SARS-CoV-2 or the novel coronavirus, that threshold is a lot lower because there's already enough immunity to other coronaviruses out there in the population that combination means that we're actually much closer to herd immunity today than we otherwise thought. And that would be the most hopeful case, is that the thing burns out and we, before even there is a vaccine or a vaccine that gets widely distributed, the virus has already done, as you put it, the forest fire has already burned through the dry wood. And again, that's still a tragedy. I don't mean to minimize the people who are dying from COVID-19. It's an incredible tragedy what's happened. But it may be that we're closer to the end than we might otherwise believe or be led to believe.
What would you say the likelihood is of another situation like this arising during our life? You look at the data over history, but obviously you are at times a skeptic, at times a contrarian. Are you optimistic that in 40 years, let's assume that a large percentage of our audience is still going to be alive and they'll be 80 or 90 years old or younger, 70, 60? Is this something that happens again in our lives, or is this something that only comes up every 100 years? What is the likelihood that we have another situation like this anytime in the next several generations?
You definitely can't rule it out. I mean, pandemics, particularly influenza-based pandemics, do happen from time to time. They're not usually as severe or as bad as this one, but they definitely do happen from time to time. The one thing that we can hope for is if in, say, 2050 or 2060, we have another situation like this, that science and technology have advanced to the point where we don't have to wait a year or 5 years to develop a vaccine. We don't have a bureaucracy like the CDC and the FDA preventing people in February in Washington State from testing for the novel coronavirus. We can distribute those tests rapidly. We figured out how to do all that so that basically in your home, you have your own little kind of lab instrument in your home, and you can just basically test for all sorts of things with that without having to actually go to a doctor or go to a CVS or what have you. So I think the more we can invest in that kind of infrastructure, the more we can have data and real-time data reporting from nursing homes and other places where vulnerable populations live, we should be able to respond to a virus like this better. But, you know, it's always theoretically possible that a virus comes along that's even more virulent, more lethal than COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, especially if you factor in the possibility of biowarfare, right? So I don't think we can ever rule out the possibility that something worse comes along. And that's all the more reason why we have to be so objective and so serious about the lessons we learned from this crisis. Because if the only lesson we learn is we hate Trump and we throw him out, then we haven't learned anything.
You mentioned testing. There's been a massive amount of discussion about testing for the coronavirus throughout the last several months. What do we need to know? What should we know about testing, its viability, its importance? What would you say the essence of the takeaway about testing should be?
Boy, there's a couple of things I'd say. First, it's important for people to understand, you know, because you hear people say, well, it's a failure of the U.S. government that there aren't more tests today. That's not actually true. The U.S. is testing more people than any other country in the world. We're testing a lot of people. The problem is, and I wrote about this at freeop.org, the original paper that we published at freeop.org, our think tank, on the pandemic. It's called A New Strategy for Reopening the Economy During COVID-19. We walked through all the science of this and how the tests that we have today, they're not perfect. They're not like the pregnancy test that people are most used to, where you just kind of take it home and you know whether you're pregnant or not with incredible accuracy. The COVID tests are not that accurate, and they take a long time to get you the results back. So if you have to wait a week to get the results from a COVID test, even if the test is available, it's not useful, because then what are you going to do for that week while you sit around and wait for the test? You might have gotten positive. Even if the test was negative, you might have gotten positive in the intervening couple of days. So testing alone doesn't matter. It's not as central at this point as people think. What really matters is some of the other things that we've talked about: herd immunity, social distancing, washing your hands, basic stuff to have hygiene. But it did matter early on. If we had enough testing early on, we could have maybe nipped this thing in the bud, like some countries have done up to this point, particularly in the Pacific Rim, the New Zealand, the Taiwan. Now, what would that have looked like? What happened was, and there was a great story, I think, in the Washington Post about this several months ago, where when the state of Washington, when they first started seeing cases of COVID-19, or what they saw was an unexplained pneumonia, and scientists in local academic centers and other labs were trying to figure this out, and they actually developed their own kind of homebrew test of the novel coronavirus, because the Chinese actually had published online the genetic sequence of the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus. So if you were a scientist in Washington, you could actually take that genetic sequence and use that to develop a test. And so they actually started doing that, and the FDA and the CDC came in, the bureaucracy came in and said, no, that's illegal. You can't do that. And basically squashed and said, no, only the CDC is legally allowed to develop the test. So we were basically waiting for the federal government to develop the test, and it turned out the CDC waited a month. They had delays of a month in developing a test because their lab was contaminated. So that was a really, really disastrous result. And what we should have had, and what we hopefully will have in the future, is a system in which testing for novel viruses is not dependent on the government. You have private sector labs, biotech companies, university scientists, all with the ability to develop tests and compare them against each other, test for accuracy, crowdsource that test development rather than depending on a single lab in Atlanta to do it for you. So that's a huge lesson that we should have learned early on. But in terms of the scale of testing today, testing is not going to be this panacea that everyone thinks it is. And I'll give you an example of why. You know, you hear a lot of people talk about, well, look at the cases. The cases are rising. But as you pointed out with Florida, right, the cases are rising in Florida, but not as many people died. Why is that? Well, a big part of the reason is that a number of those cases were in younger people. A big part of that is that people were getting tested who had very mild symptoms. And a big part of that was that you were actually reporting all that data. I'll give you an example from Europe. In France, they had exactly the same number of cases. If you look at the chart in terms of how many cases of COVID-19 they had in France, it looks almost exactly like the chart in neighboring Germany, the same number of cases. But guess what? In France, four times as many people died of COVID than died in Germany. Well, why is that? Was the virus magically four times as lethal in France as it was in Germany? No. It's that the people Germany was testing were different than the people the French were testing. I'll give an example, Denmark. In Denmark, they basically only tested people who were hospitalized for COVID. So they basically underestimate the number of cases there were. So all that to say that testing is helpful, but it's not this panacea. We're getting better. The federal government has actually moved mountains to try to increase the supply of good tests. The FDA is working overtime. They had those initial missteps, but they're now trying to recover from that initial misstep and do a lot better at rapidly improving better tests. This test that you probably talked about on your show, Clay, the saliva test, that the NBA helped pioneer, that could be a real improvement on what we have up to this point. All this to say that testing is good, and it's good that we have more tests, but testing alone isn't going to solve the problems. What you really have to do is get herd immunity or a vaccine. Those are the only reliable ways to really get this virus under control.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
We're talking to Ovik Roy. You can follow him on Twitter at AVIK. I'm Clay Travis. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. Couple of final questions for you, and you've been phenomenal here. I believe you went to school, you told me off air as we were starting, with Chris Webber. You were a year behind him. You grew up outside of Detroit, where my wife also grew up. She went to the University of Michigan. I believe you're a University of Michigan fan. Is that right?
I am, yeah. It's been a tough decade, at least on the football side, but, you know.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay, so when you see the Big Ten and the Pac-12 shut down fall sports from a obviously a perspective with which you are looking at this, did they get it right or did they get it wrong?
Well, first of all, if Chris Webber is listening, I just want to tell him, Chris, I'm so happy that you've come back to Michigan. The Fab Five has reunited, and those wounds from so long ago have been healed. All the love to you, and I'm so glad that all that is getting better now after all this time. But in terms of the Big Ten and the Pac-12 stuff, it's been such an interesting story to follow, especially over the last week, as you've obviously talked about a lot on your show. Really remarkable, and I think there's a couple things to say about it. One, the illogic of saying you're going to have tens of thousands of students come to campus, but it's too dangerous for people to play football.
Yes.
I mean, how do you think they're actually going to get COVID? It's from the other students, right? So, like, does that make any sense?
No.
And obviously, there are some colleges that have given up on having a season. But I actually take the opposite takeaway from that, which is COVID-19, you know, we talk about this in some of our work at Preop. COVID-19 in the college population is not lethal. Yes, of course, there are very rare cases of serious illness or death, but it's very, very rare. And, you know, you've heard this talk, and the talk that really reportedly has scared the chancellors and presidents in the Big Ten and Pac-12 has been myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle as a result of COVID-19. There have been a couple of cases of that. Again, a serious illness that we should be concerned about, but the studies that have been used to scare the presidents and chancellors are studies of 50-year-olds in other countries. They're not of actually college-aged athletes. And in fact, the likelihood that a college-aged athlete gets inflammatory myocarditis from COVID-19, as far as we know, is extremely low. And that's not to say you shouldn't be concerned about and you shouldn't try to be careful and you shouldn't try to protect the athletes. Of course you should. But there is, again, a lot of alarmism here rather than rigorous scientific examination of the real risk. And football players in particular play with a lot of risks every day. You know, there are football players who are permanently disabled because of playing football in college. So they're aware of risk. And what's been, I think, particularly disappointing is that the players were not part of the conversation, right? This was being determined by commissioners and presidents without their input in almost every case. And that's not to say that maybe if their input had been in there, the decision wouldn't have been dissimilar. Maybe the parents, there's a silent majority of parents who are concerned, don't want their kids playing. And that's fine. If they don't want to play, they shouldn't have to. But these decisions were being made behind closed doors with, in some cases, what appears to be sketchy scientific evidence. And I'd like to see a more open discussion where we really do go through the evidence.
Why did the experts get so much wrong? I started talking about this early, using sports as a prism, talking about the difficulty, and I'm sure you've dealt with this as well, of knowing both the numerator and the denominator. In other words, projecting a death rate or an infection rate, you need to know how many infections there were, and you need to know, how many of those people are actually dying and because of the virus, as opposed to dying with the virus. And so, you know, this Imperial College forecast out of England, which forecast over 2 million people would die in the United States, it doesn't probably surprise you that the worst case scenario forecast got way more attention in the media. But these so-called experts, the epidemiologists, the virologists, their forecasts were completely, for the most part, worthless early on when decisions were being made here. Why do you think they got so much wrong?
We could spend an hour on that topic. Before I get to that, let me say one thing else about the Big Ten. A school to keep an eye on is Purdue. Purdue is run by Mitch Daniels, who is a really smart guy who used to be the governor of Indiana, was the budget chief in the White House under George W. Bush, a really, really smart, talented, thoughtful guy about this stuff, testified before the Senate about why he was going to reopen Purdue. And they've done a lot of really interesting and sophisticated things to try to make a fall semester at Purdue work. And let me go through some of them. We don't know if it's going to work, but he's certainly doing some really interesting things that are worth keeping an eye on. First, he required that everybody test negative for COVID before coming to campus, and they sponsored the testing. They tested over 30,000 Purdue students, and they had a positivity rate of less than 1% of that student body. And they have some other plans in place. So, like, let's say you do get sick or you have had COVID, so you have immunity. Let's room those people who are now immune with the people who might have pre-existing conditions or other vulnerabilities so that they can be even more safe in those particular facilities. So there are a lot of things that Purdue is doing that I think are worth watching to see. If you compare and contrast that to UNC, which famously shut down, UNC actually only tested 1,000 of their students prior to opening up the campus. And, of course, then they had a bunch of outbreaks that they freaked out about and decided to shut everything down again, which was just stupid on every level. They should have had a better plan because people are going to test positive, and having people test positive should not be a reason to shut down the campus if you have a plan in place to handle those positive cases. So those are two schools, I think, that are like examples of a good way to handle it, a thoughtful way to handle it, and maybe a thoughtless way to handle it. Let me just go on to your question about the math modeling. I mean, it's just been – this is another part of the story that does not get enough attention today that will over time. And part of it is, as you said, or maybe the majority of it, as you said, is that journalists aren't really good at math. But people really need to dig into what these models are. There's a tendency for the average person, understandably, say, well, that guy's got a PhD in statistics. He's got a PhD in math. He's smarter than me. I should just defer to him. He's the expert. But if you actually dig into what these models are, they're incredibly simplistic, or they're based on incredibly flimsy data points about what's going to happen. It would be like saying, to use the college football analogy again, who's going to be the national champion of college football in 2032, right? Like, you can make some guesses about that, but we all know the college football landscape shifts and flows over a decade or two. Different powers emerge. So you're not going to necessarily have any idea. And yet these models are being put forward with this level of conviction. Like, well, if you don't agree with me, you're against science. And, of course, that model from the Imperial College London that predicted 2 million deaths turned out to be completely wrong. And a part of what's been happening here is that what people do, the dirty secret of a lot of models, Clay, is what they'll do is they'll take a set of data. Like, they'll take the curve of how COVID evolved in Wuhan, how many cases on this day versus that day versus that day. And then they'll just find a mathematical equation that, if you chart that mathematical equation, looks like that curve. And then say, okay, we're going to use that equation to predict what happens in the future. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Just, you know, the thing we were talking about stocks earlier, what do they say in all the stock brokerage commercials? They say past performance is not a guarantee of future results. And the same is true with viruses, right? Just because the curve has looked this way in the past doesn't mean it's going to look a certain way in the future. And yet this very simplistic way of modeling where you say, well, you know, there's this equation and it kind of looks on a graph like the way COVID-19 evolved in Wuhan, so I'm going to use that as my model to predict there's 2 million deaths. That's not science. That's basically fancy guesswork. And yet that fancy guesswork dramatically affected policy in Western economies.
Not only that, arguably that fancy guesswork literally caused a lot more deaths because that fancy guesswork was the quote-unquote expert forecast, which I think Andrew Cuomo, if we gave him truth serum, would say he believed, which is why he sent those patients back into nursing homes, right? Like, he believed they were going to need 140,000 beds because of those forecasts. Actually, they only needed 19,000. But if he had known they were only going to need 19,000, it's likely that tens of thousands of people might well be alive in this country today. They actually followed those forecast advice, which were wildly off, and as a result ended up with arguably way more people dead than would have died if they had not.
You know, another example, we were talking earlier on the show, Clay, about how all the public health experts, they were educated and trained on influenza pandemics. And so they basically went back to that. They were fighting the last war. They were drawing from those influenza pandemic playbooks to talk about COVID-19 or how to deal with COVID-19. A great example was, people don't talk about it anymore, but remember how we were all terrified that we were going to run out of ventilators? Remember?
Yes.
We were always talking about in the spring, oh gosh, we don't have enough ventilators. What are we going to do? Well, it turned out in New York City, 88% of the people who were put on ventilators died because the ventilators actually made the disease worse.
Yes.
Because it wasn't fundamentally a respiratory disease. It was fundamentally an inflammatory disease. And that's an example of where, to your point, the expert opinion about, well, this is just like influenza, we got to do what we would do in influenza pandemics, turned out to be a fatal, fatal decision.
We're talking to Avik Roy. I'm Clay Travis. This is Wins and Losses. What letter grade would you give the United States media for the way that they have covered this pandemic?
I mean, I wish I could give them a G. Because it's not even an F, right? Because, like, you know, you could graduate from high school with an F in a particular class, but what's happened here, the distortion and the misrepresentation of what's been going on. And again, I don't think that distortion has always been intentional. I think some people, are getting a certain weird pleasure out of making things look better or worse than they are. But I think a lot of people are just genuinely scared, and they're writing articles that reflect how scared they are. But that inability to put numbers in context. Oh, there was a Indiana junior high that shut down because one person had COVID. I mean, you know, you'll see these numbers on it. Well, Texas today had 500 cases. Well, what does that mean? How many people live in Texas? How many of those people are getting sick? How many of those people are dying? You never see that information. There's just been so much like that. I just, it's been very, very bad. And the only saving grace at the end of the day has been, in a sense, the existence of the internet. Because for all the things that are terrible about social media that we can complain about or whatever, it has allowed people like you and people who are these epidemiologists who have this sort of contrarian opinion, they're able to express themselves. They're able to put research out there. They're able to put analyses out there that people who want to look at the evidence can examine. And I think that has enabled us, in a sense, a kind of an end around that more traditional gatekeeping process. It hasn't been perfect. There have been websites and big internet companies that have tried to say, well, if you disagree with the World Health Organization, we're going to shut down your account. Like, the World Health Organization has gotten a lot wrong. And I think some of the tech companies have realized that was a mistake. But that's an important thing to keep an eye on. Make sure that there's always channels for alternative views, because I don't think that problem is going to get better. We're not going to magically wake up with a different news media ecosystem in which everyone's got a degree in statistics.
Yeah, and this goes to my biggest issue, and I see so many connections across so many different fabrics of American society and world society today. And the one that really kind of connects it all to me is science is about combat. And we don't think enough about the combat of ideas, right? You come up with a theory or a hypothesis, however you want to classify it, and the scientific method requires an adversarial response to that, because only by challenging hypotheses or theories can we determine what the truth really is. What I see far too often in our society today, and this is why I was saying earlier I'm a First Amendment absolutist, is it seems like we are creating arenas where only acceptable opinions are allowed to go head-to-head with each other. And I think we've seen that with the coronavirus, where science all of a sudden has become so political that if you have the belief, hey, we need to figure out a way to live with the coronavirus, we need to figure out a way to live with COVID, maybe all of these dire forecasts aren't true, you were considered to be contributing to and almost an accessory to death. That is scary to me, and I bet it's scary to you as somebody who makes a living in many ways actually diving into the data. If you can't share that data and have a legitimate debate with someone without being accused of facilitating death in the country or even, God forbid, rooting for it, that's an inherent flaw of our debate and our national discourse.
You know, I think if there's, if that's probably what you're just describing, Clay, is the single most important thing that our country and the world, but particularly our country, has to get better at. We have to have an ecosystem, a way of debating all ideas, but particularly scientific ideas, but all ideas, economic policy, politics, racial issues. We have to have a way of talking about all these issues in a way that where competing theories, competing hypotheses can be addressed and considered and not suppressed. That's incredibly important. We've always got to make sure that alternative, that contrarian approach to ideas is there. And by the way, like we were talking earlier about my time as an investor, that's the essence of every great successful investor, zig when everybody else is zagging, right? You think about Billy Beane, same thing, right? The most successful, it's true in football especially, right? You think about the people who've come up with creative ways of new offensive or defensive schemes. Sometimes those offensive and defensive schemes were invented 110 years ago, but they've just fallen out of style, so people don't adjust to them, right? So there's a real need for contrarian thinking at all times, and we've got to find a way to ensure the people who disagree with the majority point of view on a scientific issue are not characterized as anti-science merely for disagreeing with one take on the evidence. Because you can have a very evidence-driven view that's different from what another person who's looking at the same evidence concludes. And unless we have a system in which that's possible and that's allowed, we're not going to be truly scientific, we're not going to be pro-science, and we're not going to actually do right by our country.
Final question for you, and this is obviously predictive in nature, but I'm curious what you think. Today, there is a national consensus that the Vietnam War was mismanaged and that we shouldn't have been involved in Vietnam. I think there's also a consensus that maybe among most people that the Iraq War did not make sense when you consider the cost in lives, in economics, all those different things. And that sometimes takes, and you know this as well as I do, the retrospective arc of history. We have to go back in 25 years from now, 30 years, 15 years, whatever the math may be. We have a clearer vision of what the full story was, right? And that's ultimately what ends up being written. Will people look back on our response to the coronavirus in 10 years and write honest portrayals of what we got right and what we got wrong? Or is the media so left-wing convinced? Because what's fascinating is the left-wingers ended up being right in many ways about the Iraq War and about Vietnam, right? Without getting into the particulars of those wars, but that made them willing to acknowledge for the public, hey, we got this wrong. I think the left wing has gotten the coronavirus completely wrong, right? I think that it's been a failure more so by left-wing media than anyone. Will we get an honest appraisal of the coronavirus and our response to it in the next 10 or 20 years? Or is it so intensely political that no one is ever going to admit what they got wrong and what we failed from as a country?
Well, Clay, it's so interesting that you bring up the Vietnam War, because there was a famous book written about the Vietnam War by David Halberstam called The Best and the Brightest.
Yes.
And it's all about how the Vietnam War was prosecuted by the greatest science-oriented experts of the country at that time. They were all Harvard and Yale graduates. They all had impressive resumes, lots of degrees. The main general or the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, was one of these guys. He pioneered, you know, analytic thinking in the way the Ford Motor Company worked in the middle of the 20th century. And that's what, you know, he tried to basically apply those lessons of, you know, quantitation and metrics for everything to the way the Army operated in Vietnam. It turned out to be a complete catastrophic failure. And so my hope is that we have some similar examination of what happened in this crisis, and we draw the lessons from this crisis that David Halberstam was able to pull out of the Vietnam War when he wrote that book, because that is an incredibly important part. We have to have a lot more humility around what we call expertise, and we have to have a genuinely, genuinely sincere openness, particularly in this era of big data. So much information is online. So many people can take a look at that data and come up with it. We've got to have a much more open source, crowdsourced approach to thinking about evidence. And if we do that, we'll do a much better job for vulnerable populations in this country and many others.
Do you want to write a book on this to help tell the story after this is all done? Because at some point, we're going to go back to normalcy. But if we don't learn from the errors that we have made, and I think there's a strong argument that the worst decision in my life was the war in Iraq, right? I think you can make that argument. Or the 21st century. Vietnam was before you and I, but I think for older people who are listening to that, that's probably the biggest failure in American policy. I feel like the coronavirus is in that level, but I wonder if it's ever going to be acknowledged in the same way.
Well, you know, I thought about writing a book about it, and maybe I will. I got to find the spare time because I'm
pretty busy
running our think tank, freeapp.org. But maybe I will. And you're right that that debate needs to happen, and I think it will. I hope it will, because this virus, not just the deaths, but the lockdowns, the school closures, it has affected all of us. Right? We've all been affected by it. It's too important not to have that examination take place. And so hopefully people like you and me and so many others who've been carrying that flag will do their part to make sure that we have that conversation.
You've done almost 2 hours with us here. I think we could go on and on. It's been fascinating. I encourage everybody listening to go follow Ovik. Man, after all that time, I was trying to get your
I'm sorry. Blame my mom and dad.
Yeah, I know. It'd be so much easier if they'd started your name with an O instead of an A. @AVIK, go follow him. He does incredible work. If you've enjoyed this conversation, thank him for spending the time with us. I'm Clay Travis. Thank you again for coming on, and this has been Wins and Losses.